As I said, we've been following this theme of the verses of the Sevenfold Puja. And the Sevenfold Puja has a kind of narrative to it. It's a bit like a story or something like that. And it begins with your recognition of something. You're recognizing something higher, something beyond you, something that gives meaning and value to your life, and so on. And when we come to this particular stage, going for refuge, it's like you're making a decision at this point. You're making a decision that you want to move in the direction of that which you see or you have seen as being meaningful and valuable. So if when we come to the end of our life, if you imagine coming to the end of your life and you want to be able to look back and say, I've lived my life to the full, I've lived my life fully, I've done the best I could, as it were, I've lived my life fully. So you have to try and imagine what that would mean for you. What would it mean to look back and say, I've lived my life to the full? How would that manifest, as it were? I think this, for some people that kind of contemplation might mean they might have a very kind of mundane sense of what living their life to the full might mean. It might be being a millionaire or traveling the world or something like that. Maybe it could be something like raising a family successfully. But for in the context of the Dharma, in the context of Buddhism, for someone who's got a spiritual aspiration, living life to the full could be it might bring to mind lots of different images. It might bring to mind images of the Buddha, for instance, or great Buddhist teachers like Milarepa or Padmasambhava or whatever. It might bring to mind something like that. Whatever it brings to mind, in a way, it's an exercise worth doing. It's worth imagining yourself at the end of your life and being able to say, I have lived life fully. And just imagine, what would that mean to you? And that the answer to that question, it's an imaginative exercise, but the answer to the question can give shape and direction to your life. So for the purposes of this evening, what I'm talking about, living your life fully, means going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. So it means doing whatever is necessary to lead you in the direction of Buddhahood, enlightenment, awakening, whatever you want to call it. And in traditional terms, that's spoken of as going for refuge. Buddham saranam gacchami, Dhammam saranam gacchami, and Sangham saranam gacchami. So that's what I want to look into this evening, what that means. What does it mean to go for refuge to the Buddha? What does it mean to go for refuge to the Dharma? What does it mean to go for refuge to the Sangha? So we talk about this in different ways because the language of going for refuge is a bit kind of abstract in a way, or it can bring up images that are not, for some people, not very inspiring or not even very comprehensible. So we sometimes talk about it as putting something at the center of your life, and that your life is, as it were, orientated around what's central, the central values, or what has central meaning in your life. Or we talk about it in terms of making a commitment to something, making a commitment to move towards something, or making a commitment to particular practices. In a way, it doesn't matter how we talk about it. The main thing is that we have some kind of understanding of what it is that we're trying to do. The image of refuge is because the Buddha, and not the Buddha in a historical sense, but the Buddha's experience of awakening, of Buddhahood, is seen as something reliable. It's a reliable a reliable place to find yourself in life, as it were, to be awakened. It's a bit like saying all other states of consciousness are unsatisfactory, they're temporary, and they're going to cause you pain in one way or another. Awakening is reliable. That's why we call it a refuge or a shelter or whatever. In the actual verse in the puja, it talks about the Buddha in plural. It talks about powerful protectors and mighty conquerors. So it's using very kind of poetic language. Conquering there means overcoming greed, hatred and delusion, overcoming those kind of mental poisons. Protectors, not protectors in the sense of being a savior or something like that, but in the sense of having made available something that you can use in order to live your life fully, if you see what I mean. So I want to talk, I'm going to talk separately about going for refuge to the Buddha, going for refuge to the Dharma, and going for refuge to the Sangha. And I'll start with the Buddha. And I want to look at that, what it means to go for refuge to the Buddha, to make a commitment, or to put the Buddha at the centre of your life, or whatever. I want to look at that under a number of headings, probably four or five different headings. So that the first heading I use is what I call affirmation. So the first thing is it's being clear that the Buddha, what the Buddha represents, as it were, what the Buddha symbolizes. So the Buddha was an enlightened human being. So the Buddha is not a god, not a son of God, not a prophet of God, not the ninth avatar of Vishnu, not a great philosopher like Socrates, not a religious leader. The Buddha is none of those things. The Buddha is an awakened or enlightened human being. So what does that mean? That begs another question. I thought, rather than try to answer that myself, I've cheated, and I'm taking a quote from Bhante Sangharakshita, which talks about what enlightenment is, and therefore what the Buddha is. And he says, we can say that it is a state of pure, clear, radiant awareness. And it's sometimes specified that in this state of awareness, one no longer makes any emotional distinction between oneself and others. That sense we have of an inner world set against the world outside is entirely transcended. There is just one continuous, pure, homogeneous awareness extending freely in all directions. And it is, moreover, an awareness of things as they really are. So this pure, clear awareness is also spoken of as an awareness of reality. It's a state of knowledge, not in the ordinary sense of someone accumulating notions about things, but rather a seeing of things directly and truly, unmediated by any separate subject doing the seeing. It's a spiritual vision, even a transcendental vision, which is free from delusion or misconception, free from all wrong, crooked thinking, all vagueness, all obscurity, all prejudice, all mental conditioning. He goes on to say, however, this is not the end of it. Enlightenment can be described as full illumination, as transcendental awareness, as wisdom, but it is also an overflowing of profound love and compassion for all that lives. It's described too as supreme bliss or complete emancipation, the bliss of release from the subjective ills and limitations of conditional existence. It's also characterized by inexhaustible energy continually bubbling forth, total spontaneity, uninterrupted creativity. Therefore, the actual experience cannot be described at all. Only by reflection on the Dharma, reflecting on the Buddha's teaching as well as his example, by deeper communication with friends, and above all by meditation, can we get some real intuition of what the enlightenment of the Buddha consists in. So that's trying to give some kind of almost like hint or glimpse of what it mean, what the Buddha means, what the Buddha symbolizes, what the Buddha stands for. This state of consciousness, which is not something you can get your head around. It's something really that you have to move towards experiencing. And of course, with this kind of thing, it can seem like it's so distant that it's impossible. But I think anyone who has meditated or whatever will have some sense of the fact that our mind isn't what we normally experience, that kind of surface of thinking and daydreaming and all the rest of it. That's just the kind of surface ripples on our mind, that our mind is actually quite vast. And sometimes you drop into something that gives you a glimpse of that in meditation, especially if you're on retreat and so on. You can get a much stronger sense of that. And that is you getting a glimpse of something even vaster and vaster and vaster than that. You're getting it's a bit like you've lived in a pond, and then you become aware of a lake through meditating, and the lake can give you an intimation of what the ocean might be like. Yeah. So the ocean is the Buddha's state of consciousness. So having a sense of the Buddha as enlightened, as symbolizing the ideal of enlightenment for all humanity, we can open our hearts. We can open our hearts in gratitude, in devotion, in aspiration. And Bhante says, the image of the Buddha, with which everyone is familiar, seems a figure of unfathomable knowledge and compassion. Its message is not strident or defensive. It does not call for fear or guilt. Instead, it triggers off a subtle perplexity in ourselves, a questioning of our deepest assumptions about what is possible, about what can be known and what cannot be known, about what a human being can become. So we may recognize in it something in ourselves that we have not perhaps taken into account. And the belief may stir in us that such knowledge and serenity might be available to ourselves. So this is the first stage, I think, in going for refuge to the Buddha. It's a stage of affirming, recognizing that the Buddha was an enlightened human being. And therefore, you could say, an ideal model for humanity, for all humanity. So Buddhism begins with the Buddha. Buddhism begins with the Buddha's experience of awakening. We can use lots of metaphors for what that might mean. We can speak of it in terms of an ideal, indicating somewhere that we want to go in that direction. Or we can talk about Buddha nature, indicating it as a potential that we can release or make available. Or we can talk about nirvana. Nirvana means blowing out. So that might indicate what we want to let go of or what we want to escape from. So that's the first thing. The next thing I talk about under the heading of investigation. And this refers to getting to know yourself. So the Buddha is your ideal, let's say. It's where you want to go. But the question then is, but what are you? Who are you? What are you? And this aspect of going for refuge is about looking into who you are. discovering who you are, yes, unveiling who you are. So it involves looking into your conditioning, you know, your family conditioning, your national conditioning, your school, society, class, religion, all of those things that have conditioned you as the person you are. So looking into your conditioning, looking at your habits, the particular ways you have of thinking, the particular attitudes you have, because we all have that. So sometimes we barely notice it, but we have our own particular way of looking at things, our own particular habits of mind, as well as, of course, the habits of doing and so on. Looking at our views, what kind of views of the world or of other people and so on motivate us. Looking, of course, at our behaviour and our speech and so on. So getting to know ourselves as thoroughly as possible. And we do that, of course, through meditation. We get to know ourselves through meditation. We get to know ourselves through communication with other people, especially if it's open and honest communication. It may include things like sharing our life stories and so on. And we get to know ourselves through reflection, asking ourselves questions, going deeper into things. So getting to know ourselves is not about passing judgment on ourselves. It's about, you could say it's about being honest with ourselves, about not hiding from ourselves. So not hiding from yourself, being honest with yourself, getting to know yourself. So that's the second part of going for refuge to the Buddha. You go for refuge to the Buddha by getting to know yourself and getting to know the Buddha, as it were. Those are the two ends of the spectrum. But you need to get to know yourself, because getting to know yourself in this sense means you become a more whole person. You become, as we say, more integrated. If you become a more whole person, you've got more energy, and there's more of you moving in the direction you want to go in. The third thing I've talked about here is transformation. So knowing yourself and having a direction to your life means that you can then begin to transform yourself in that direction, as it were. Especially, of course, through working on things like your behaviour and your speech and your mental habits. But what this really involves is relying on what we call the law of karma. So the law of karma, as you all know, states that actions have consequences, that skillful, positive actions being thoughts as well as physical actions and words, that positive, skillful actions have beneficial consequences for ourselves and others, and unskillful or negative actions have bad consequences. And relying on the law of karma, it means having a... We need to take on board what the law of karma really means, as it were. We need to be able to, as it were, have faith in it, that actually it works, basically. It works. So it's not about believing that actions have consequences. It's about living in that way, as it were. It's about living out the fact that actions have consequences. Yeah, that's what it means to have right view. Right view isn't about thinking something. It's about living it out. Yeah? And then the fourth thing I talk about is emulation. So we can think in terms of going for refuge as emulating the Buddha. So the five precepts, the five ethical precepts, they're, as it were, a description of how a Buddha, the normal behaviour, you could say, the normal behaviour of a Buddha. And we can use this idea of emulating the Buddha to encourage us to be ethical, to encourage us to meditate and to reflect and communicate well. Because that's what the Buddha did. It really helps if we know something about the Buddha's life from the Pali Canon and so on, because if we do, we can see that that's what he did. He meditated, he behaved with kindness and compassion, and he communicated well, and he reflected. He says himself that before he was enlightened, what he did was he reflected. He reflected on his own mental states and whether they were skillful or unskillful. Yeah. Now, of course, emulating the Buddha doesn't just mean emulating the historical Buddha. We could also look at other teachers, others that we admire, and it may even be living people, it may even be people around us that we look up to, that we can emulate. Or if we, another way of thinking of this is we could ask ourselves in particular situations, well, what would the Buddha do? Or what would Milarepa do? Or what would Sangharakshita do? Or whatever, depending on who it is or what it is that you're looking up to. What would they do in this situation? And that can help you to try and emulate them, try and follow them. And the last thing I talk about in terms of going for refuge to the Buddha is contemplation. There's a traditional practice, contemplation or recollection of the Buddha, Buddhanu Sati. So contemplating the qualities of wisdom, compassion, energy, and so on. And knowing, as I said, knowing the stories of the Buddha's life really helps with that. But we could also contemplate or reflect on the symbolism of the archetypal figures from Mahayana Buddhism, because they've got a rich symbolism of colour and gesture and association with particular animals and so on and so on. And that rich symbolism is all about the qualities of wisdom and compassion and energy. But it's approaching those qualities in a way that really appeals to the imagination, and a way that really gets below the surface of our thinking, intellectualizing minds. Yeah, it goes right into the heart, as it were. So contemplating those figures as well can be a way of moving us in that direction of enlightenment, or any kind of ritual or devotional practices. They are, in a sense, a contemplation of the Buddha, a contemplation of the qualities of enlightenment. And all of those kind of things are trying to move us emotionally so that we become receptive to, or grateful to, or reverent of that which is higher. I was thinking, lastly, just in terms of going for refuge to the Buddha more deeply and more strongly, we could ask ourselves some questions. We could ask ourselves questions like, well, what does awakening mean to me? What does it mean to me? Or what steps could I take to know myself better? Or even, do I really believe that I can change? Yeah, because we're talking about transformation and so on. Do I really believe that I can change? Or maybe what particular quality of the Buddha would I most like to emulate? Yeah. So some ways of making this much more concrete, so it's not just an abstract idea. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to move on to... This is taking a bit longer than I thought, but anyway, I hope it's okay. Going for refuge to the Dharma. So the first thing about going for refuge to the Dharma being both the teaching of the Buddha and, in a way, the reality behind that teaching. The first thing about that is that we need to know it. We need to know what it is, yeah? What is the teaching of the Buddha? And in our own case in Sri Ratna, what is Bhante's elucidation of the Buddha's teaching? So in order to know the Dharma, we need to study it, discuss it, explore it in various ways. And we, especially we need to explore the core teachings, like, for instance, teaching on pratityasamuppada, the teaching on dependent arising, and all the implications of that, one of which is the law of karma. And then, as we're knowing the teachings, or studying and discussing them, we need to try and apply them to our lives, yeah? Bhante said that he used to always ask himself, what is the purpose of this teaching? So he would read something in the scriptures, and he'd say, well, what is the purpose of it? What's the point of this teaching? So for instance, we shouldn't just think something like, all things are impermanent, and kind of like tick the box, got that one. No, we should take it much more deeply than that. You know, what are the implications for me? Do I really believe it, in a way? Do I really, really believe it? We should try to apply it to the things that we're attached to, the people we're attached to. All things, everything and everybody is impermanent. So you're impermanent. That means that every bit of you is impermanent. You know, your legs, your ears, your nose, your heart, all of you is impermanent. Your thoughts, your emotions, your resentments, your complaints, your desires, your joy, your happiness, everything is impermanent. So we can go into it deeper and deeper. And of course, going into impermanence doesn't just mean that things come to an end. It also means that things come into being, that things grow. And we should also reflect on that side of impermanence. And reflect on the implications of that for ourselves. Yeah? So that's just an example of just that one little bit of the Dharma, that getting to know it means going into it. That's the point I'm making. And of course, going for refuge to the Dharma means practicing it. It means practicing ethics, meditation, going on retreat, friendship, study, and so on. And particularly it means practicing reflection, I think. The reflection is a really crucial practice, asking yourself questions such as, what do I really believe? Or what do I want to do with my life? Asking those kind of questions can take us deeper and deeper. I think going for refuge to the Dharma can be really summed up in three words from the Threefold Puja. Those words are study, practice, realize. So that is what going for refuge to the Dharma amounts to in the end. And the last one of those, realizing is not something that can be forced. It arises in dependence on conditions. It arises in dependence on a particular intensity of practice. It's a matter of experience, and then that experience is followed up by embodying the truth of what has been experienced, embodying it in how we live our lives and how we relate to other people. There's a lot more I could say about that, but I'll move on to going for refuge to the Sangha. So I've got a quote here from Bhante. He quite neatly sums up what this is, so that's quite handy. He says it means looking for inspiration and guidance to those followers of the Buddha, both past and present, who are spiritually more advanced than oneself. That's simple enough, isn't it? Looking for inspiration and guidance to those followers of the Buddha, both past and present, who are spiritually more advanced than oneself. So the Dharma is not an abstraction. It's embodied in flesh and blood people. And we need to be in contact with people who embody the Dharma to a greater degree than we do. There's a kind of spiritual hierarchy, and what we need to do is recognize who are those people who are spiritually more advanced. Maybe that's perhaps not such a simple matter. How do you know? whether someone is more spiritually advanced than you are? I mean, how do you know anything about anybody, in a way? How do you know somebody? I've found in the Buddha's, in the Anguttara Nikaya, the Buddha talks about how to get to know somebody. Yeah? And he mentions four things. He says, four facts about a person can be known from four circumstances. So by living together with a person, their virtue can be known. And this too, only after a long time, not casually, by close attention, not without attention, by one who is wise, not by one who is stupid. So that's by living together. Then he says, by having dealings with a person, their integrity can be known. And then it repeats, only after a long time, not casually, by close attention, and by one who is wise. And then it says, in misfortune, a person's fortitude can be known. So their strength of character. And fourthly, by conversation, a person's wisdom can be known. So by living together, by having dealings, in misfortune, and by conversation. So basically, I think he's saying, you have to spend time with people. You have to see them in different circumstances. And by seeing and observing someone in different circumstances and spending time with them, that way you get to know whether they really are spiritually advanced or whether they're just, what's the word, they got a good front. Yeah. So you know somebody by seeing their ethical practice, seeing their faith, seeing their awareness and so on. And he talks about going for refuge to the Sangha involving finding inspiration and guidance. So looking for inspiration and guidance. So questions arise there like, well, what inspires us? What inspires you? And do we want guidance? Yeah. Do we welcome guidance? Yeah. So so that's the Sangha, as it were, in terms of looking upwards or looking to those who are more advanced. But there's also the Sangha of all those that we're on the path together with, our peers, as it were. And going for refuge in that sense means communication, it means creating friendships, it means confiding in people, confessing, and so on. And through all of those things, we transform ourselves, and transforming ourselves is what going for refuge is about. So Sangha, or spiritual community, supports our practice. It makes it possible a lifestyle that supports our practice, because we can meet others and go on retreat with them, we can study with them, we can meditate with them, even in some cases live and work with them. But just having the people that we can do those things with, it provides a context where we can give expression to our values and our ideals. We can share them with others. And that's really important. To be able to express something is really important. Sometimes you really do not know yourself unless you can express something. It's like if it's in the privacy of your own mind, you really don't know it fully until it's expressed. Yeah, and then it starts to take on a kind of reality. A Buddhist center like this one is a result of Sangha. It's a result of spiritual community, and of course it's also a condition for Sangha, for Sangha to flourish and expand and so on. So it's something to be valued as part of our going for refuge to the Sangha, because going for refuge to the Sangha means being involved in creating the Sangha, in creating the spiritual community. It's surprising in a way how easy it is to take things for granted. We can take for granted things like having a Buddhist centre or having a Sangha night or whatever. But it's worth reminding ourselves that everything, all of these things exist because of other people. They all exist because, you could say, because of the generosity of other people, of people putting in their time, putting in their energy, putting their money in and so on, over years and years and years. All of these things exist on the basis of that giving of energy and so on by lots and lots of different people. And that's what we're entering into when we're entering into the Sangha. We're entering into that stream of giving, and we become part of that. You know? So that's something about going for refuge to the Buddha, going for refuge to the Dharma, going for refuge to the Sangha. I hope it's done what I said I'd try and do, which is take us a little bit deeper into each of those and what they mean. And as I said, if you've got any questions now, I'm happy to have a go at answering.
Quick question, reference, Rinkesha, the reading from Bamse on the nature of enlightenment description, who is that from exactly?
It's from Who is the Buddha? Page
36. That's the Surasa test.
Which quality of the Buddha would you most like to develop?
Me personally? Oh, good quality. I think I could do with being more compassionate. I think being compassionate is not as easy as it seems. Because being compassionate is not just about responding to obvious suffering. It's about responding to even suffering that's not immediately obvious as well. Because the compassion in the Buddhist sense is about people not being awakened in a way, not having wisdom themselves. So being compassionate is about responding, in a sense, to everybody with that kind of kindness, open-heartedness and helpfulness. And yes, I could do more of that.
Grisha, how do you think that in a way we should balance our efforts in going for refuge between the three jewels? Should we, should we be putting more effort between the one you're finding hardest or balancing equal efforts between three jewels?
Yes, it's a good question. I think the first thing I think to say about that is there isn't really three jewels. There isn't really Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. It's just a way of talking about something. But actually they're all so intertwined and enmeshed that actually you don't have one without the other. You know what I mean? The Buddha's awakening gives rise, or is, the Dharma, you could say. And the Sangha is the manifestation of that in the world. Yeah. So, in a way, you don't really have three different avenues that you're going down. They're an integrated whole. And so, in a way, you're just moving in one direction. But to bring the question back to like how we might practice, I think it is good, with the help of your friends or whatever, to try and see what it is that you need to do most, if you see what I mean, at any particular time in your life. So there might be a time when you need to focus on meditation, and that might be the most helpful thing. Or there might be a time when you need to focus on ethics or even just a part of ethical practice, like your speech or something like that. I think, in a way, the worst thing is to just do what you feel like doing, because it's what you like. You see what I mean? Because that means that you are looking for inspiration and guidance to yourself, and looking for inspiration and guidance to yourself means that you will stay on the level of yourself, yeah, which isn't what you're trying to do in terms of moving towards the ideal. So really you need to be in communication with others and trying to discover what it is that you need to do. What do you need to do in order to, as it were, expand beyond yourself? Yeah, not to rely too much on your own ideas about what's practice. Because so, it's so easy to make mistakes. It's so easy to think, I need to do a lot more meditation, when actually maybe that's not what you need at all. Or I need to do a lot more study, when actually that might not be what you need. There's a case in one of the Buddhist scriptures, I cannot remember where it is, it's a Mahayana teaching, where there's a young monk who's just been ordained, and so he's ordained somewhere in the mountains or whatever, and he goes back to where the other monks are, and he decides that he's going to go into a solitary retreat for a month or whatever. He's just been ordained, he's full of enthusiasm, and off he goes to solitary retreat to get enlightened or whatever. Then along comes his teacher, and his teacher asks, where is he? You know, where has he gone? And he's told that he's gone on solitary retreat. And he says, go and get him back. There's work to be done here. He needs to be here. He needs to be doing the work. He doesn't need to be on solitary. So, you know, sometimes what we think we ought to be doing or what we want to do might not be the best thing. I don't know if I've answered your question.
I have a question that rolls out of that. Okay. Where do you go for the guidance to know it?
Yes, well, I mean, the way we've set things up here is that when you start to get more involved, you get involved, say, with study. So in a study group, you start to get to know people and make friends, but you're also hearing different points of view and so on. And also, hopefully, the older members that you meet and whatever will be able to guide you. But in a way, you have to... It's like that is your job, is to seek out the guidance, to find it where you will, but seek it out. Yeah. That's what you have to do. Yeah.
And that can be quite hard to do.
Yeah.
In my experience, when I first came here, taking quite a long time to face that, and then to be able to know, recognize that I needed something that I didn't know.
Yes.
Actually, even though I thought I was following it all, I didn't get it. And was saying things like, how do I meet more order members? How do I make friends with them? They're so busy. And how can I make friends with more people? And it's quite touchy about it, you know. It was only in the experience of going and doing that I found out what it meant. I can't explain it, but I had an aversion to seeking people out. Particularly if I thought they were going to tell me something I didn't want to hear, I suppose. So that's been a big thing for me.
But it can seem artificial in a way. But it's interesting that in other traditions, like for instance in Tibetan tradition, in some ways it's very artificial. It's set up as a thing. You've got a guru who tells you what to do. And so even in the Zen tradition, the master just tells you what to do. You don't necessarily have any, in those cases, you don't necessarily have any personal relationship with them. But in our case, we tend to advise that it's done in that kind of way. But yeah, it is a seeking out, and it's not necessarily a big thing in a way, because sometimes just a very brief chat with somebody can be enormously helpful. I mean, when I was first getting involved with Triratna, we used to meet Bhante for 15 minutes, maybe twice a year. You meet him for 15 minutes, and he would tell us something about it. But even a few words was enough to help us, to keep us on the right track. It's not, you don't need a huge amount of money, you need a huge amount of guidance. But I think that what you're pointing to is being receptive to it and really wanting it is the important thing, isn't it? Yeah. Because you can get a lot of teaching from people, but if you're not actually taking it in, then it's just so much words, you know what I mean? Whereas actually the best thing is just a few words that you actually take in, act on. Yeah.
And you don't do that till you're ready. You can't. I can't do that till I was ready to hear.
Exactly.
That.
Yeah, I see. That's right. Yeah, because sometimes it's not, as you say, it's not what you want to hear.
Thank you.
So there was something in what you said about how do I get to meet more people? Perhaps there are different dimensions. There are two dimensions: as meeting more people and having deeper relationships with the people that we already know. And so another way to get to know or have a deeper, stronger connection with all the members might be to just pick an order member that you already know and have a deeper connection with them.
That's right, yeah. That's a good way of looking at it, yeah.
I'm sure everybody here knows at least one.
Perhaps.
We don't plant.
Any other questions before we have our tea break? It was all very straightforward, wasn't it? Okay, let's have a cup of tea and we'll come back at 9:10.